ميكال ستروبل اللوم سيكلمنا فوق سجات دا شي ديفرنت من اللي تكلمنا سيسا إلا ليش سيسا الكونشنتراين أكتر فوق بايس ويهت كيف تعمل بيش تجيب القديم تبروموف اللينغوا تيو وكيف دان صار في البايس تيو الكاتالونيا اللوم سن نخرجو أكتر على الوسا فرصة عشان البروفيسور هذا يبدأ في فياجي تيو البرا وعليك سيتكلم فوق الونيوني أوروبية الونيوني أوروبية اللي برا مليا كيف تعرفوا مسا تا جبرا تا بايز ديفرنتي يا جبرا وكل تا إلسنا ديفرنتي تحف نكتار إلسنا ملي نحسبو نورمالمنت إلا ليش برا مليا اللينجوي تا البايز اللينجوي ناسيونالي emmu koll il-lingwi nazzjonali żgħar, il-lingwi minoritarji. U il-professur Strubel ħadem ħafna u ħafna fuq dawn il-lingwi minoritarji ġifieri gruppi ġemgħat ta' kelliema u qed ngħidu gruppi jekk nitkellmu fuq il-pajjiż tiegħu il-Katalonja, qed nitkellmu fuq grupp li għandek madwar 7 miljun ruħ jew 8 miljun ruħ jitkellmuh, jiġifieri mhumiex gruppi żgħar. Illi għandhom lingwi partikolari tagħhom. Fuq dan ix-xogħol ħadem ħafna l-professur Strubel, ħadem ħafna fih dan organizzazzjoni tal-Unjoni Ewropea, kien responsabbli għal ħafna proġetti, fosthom wieħed li jismu il-Euro Mosaic, all right, Euro Mosaic, li jfisser li kien sforz u għadu għaddej wasal fit-tielet fażi tiegħu, li fih l-studjuzi għedin jipruvaw jamlu mappa tal-Europa bid-deskrizzjoni tal-lingwi partikolari tagħha fil-pajjiżi kollha. Għalhekk inħallikom f'dejn il-professur Strubel illi barra milli se jkellimna fuq l-Unjoni Ewropea u jgħidilna x'taħseb l-Unjoni Ewropea, x'inhu ma direzzjonijiet li għandha għal-lingwi, żguri li se jinvolvina minħabba illi aħna l-ilsin tagħna huwa ilsin ukoll membru issa tal-Unjoni Ewropea u mhux biss huwa ftit partikolari għax huwa l-iżgħar ilsin nazzjonali fl-Unjoni Ewropea, l-iżgħar ilsin uffiċjali u għandu partikolaritajiet oħra bħal ma huma li huwa l-ewwel ilsin semitiku fl-Unjoni Ewropea. U għalhekk tajjeb illi meta naħsbu fil-Malti ma nibqgħux naħsbu kif konna naħsbu s'issa fuq il-Malti f'Malta, imma anke fuq id-dimensjonijiet tiegħu fil-pożizzjoni ġdida tiegħu flimkien mal-ilsna l-oħra. X'vantaġġi, x'iżvantaġġi, x'futur u iktar minn dan x'politika lingwistika għandu jkollna meta llum inħarsu lejn il-Malti. Il-professur Strubel.
Ilum kon sem kelimkom bil Malti imma kaluli aħarle.
Thank you, no, please. I promise you when I reach my lecture number 25 I will be able to say even more, much more. But I don't threaten you with a whole lecture in Maltese, in my Maltese. Thank you very much for coming. I don't know if there's a football match on the television or whatever, but it's very kind of you because it makes my visit worthwhile. And I would like to mention that today I was privileged to attend the official presentation of the new National Council for the Maltese Language, of whom the first chair has just presented me. And I wish the council and the Maltese people every success in promoting your language, which, as I said on Monday, just means one thing, using it. That is the way, basically, of promoting a language and of making sure that everyone can contribute to its future. As you have just said, I will today try and start the discussion talking about language policy in the European Union. the institutions of the European Union are not language planning bodies as such. There's no central language planning unit, but there are at least five, I can think of six, ways in which language is involved in the activities of these institutions. And I shall deal with these five or six issues separately. One is the language or languages in which the institutions of the Union make noises. In other words, what languages do these institutions use in effect? Secondly is the issue of in what languages does the Union correspond with the citizens of Europe? Thirdly, I'll make brief reference to the organization of the language services that can cover the needs that these first two issues raise. And then the important issue of foreign language learning, which we will try and put in the context of European integration and building a single market for not only for goods and products, but also for the labor market. Then I will make a short reference to the issue of European Union programs which are specifically designed to promote multilingualism in other ways. And finally, as you suggested, I will make reference to lesser used languages in Europe and the way they are or are not treated within the Union. But first, I have point number naught. What languages are we going to talk about today? And we're going to talk about several categories of languages. The most obvious one that we think of are the languages which are the national languages or the official languages of the member states of the Union. That's the most obvious one we all think of. But then the Union has some programs which are open to languages which are also official and national languages of states, but not states that belong to the Union, instead states that have some association with the Union. Thirdly, official regional languages or lesser used languages which are official within the countries but not outside and certainly not within the institutions of the Union. Fourthly, further minority languages, less used languages, which don't even have recognition within the member states. And we always must remember that some languages have one status in one country and a different status in another country. And we will make some reference to those very briefly. All of this will be very brief. Here we have a map of Europe, but it's not a map, it's not a political map of Europe.
Et inxandru taħdita tal-professur Mikel Strubel, mil-Katalonja fuq il-qada tal-lingwi fl-Unjoni Ewropea.
We have to bear in mind, let's say, that the borders, the frontiers between languages in Europe don't coincide always, they sometimes do, with the frontiers of the member states or the countries in Europe. In the case of Malta, they do because you have a coastline and the fish up to now don't speak much Maltese. I'm confident that this will change in the future. But in most of continental Europe, you will find that the borders of the states don't coincide with the borders of the member states. In other words, languages can find themselves in minority situations, and I'll give you a few examples in a moment. So let me first mention the important issue of the languages in which the European institutions function. In what languages do they work? And the first point to make is, well, in what language did they decide to actually become a union? In other words, in what languages was the treaty signed? And if we go back, of course, there have been a series of treaties. The very original treaty, which was the Treaty of Rome, was signed in four languages. It was signed in four languages, which were the four languages that were official in the member states that signed that treaty. There was Italian, it was French, it was Dutch, and it was German. There were not four countries, though. There were six countries. And at that time, Luxembourg, which was one of the six, didn't have Luxembourgish as an official language. It had French and it had German. Ah, well, I've already said those two. And Belgium is the other case of a multilingual country whose official languages I have also already mentioned, French and Dutch. So the first six countries had four official languages to give to the language of the treaty.
Et inxandru t-taħdita tal-professur Mikel Strubel mil-Katalonja fuq il-qada tal-lingwi fl-Unjoni Ewropea.
As the European Economic Community developed from six members up to the European Union of how many members? 25? Each time there has been an enlargement, the number of languages in which the treaty of accession has been signed has been larger. And nearly every single time, the national official language of the new member state was one of the languages in which the treaty was signed. So when Great Britain, when the United Kingdom joined, English, an English version was added. When Ireland joined, an Irish version was added. When Finland, when Sweden, when Austria, no. Austria only has one official language, which is German, which was already one of the treaty languages. But all the way down, the new member states have brought in new languages. This is so that the treaty is valid inside each member state. Member states regarded it as impossible to transfer part of the sovereignty if this agreement was not available to all the citizens in their own language. And this principle of legal certainty has been the main driving force in the second part of what I'm going to say. Because one thing is the language in which the treaties are signed, and another is the official languages and the working languages of the machinery of the European Union. The very, very, very first decision of the very, very first council meeting was precisely to answer that question. In what language are we going to function? And it was fairly natural at the beginning that they said, well, the treaty has been signed in four languages. Let us have four working languages and four official languages. And the position of the council has always been that official language and working language means the same thing. In other words, no one is on one list but not on the other list. But at the same time, the principle on paper, we'll see that in practice it isn't quite the same, all these languages are equal. And I would say one thing is equality and the other thing is that the actual use is or is not the same in all cases. So since the very first regulation, the number of official and working languages has been decided by the council. It's not democratic, it's by the member states, the club members, throughout all the enlargements. So the number of official and working languages has increased at almost exactly the same rate as the number of treaty languages has increased. There's one single exception to that. In other words, the list of treaty languages is one language longer than the list of official and working languages. And which is that language which is on the first list but not on the second list? Does anyone know? Irish, well done, very good. Irish is a treaty language, and on that score it has a number of, let's say, consequences, but it isn't an official or working language. We'll see what those consequences are in a moment.
Et inxandru t-taħdita tal-professur Mikel Strubel mil-Katalonja fuq il-qada tal-lingwi fl-Unjoni Ewropea.
That map looks familiar, but there are some odd colors somewhere. And you say, that's not a country. Look at Germany. Germany is chopped up. The Ukraine has a kind of strange shape. And then we've got Catalan, of course, down the side there. And if you look in more detail, you'll find, well, there aren't the political frontiers there, so you can't really tell much of the difference. You've got Sami right at the top there, and you've now learnt a little bit of Catalan. Mapa Linguistic d'Europa. I won't translate that. So the treaty language we have talked about, and the official and working languages we have also talked about. We've talked about the very first regulation, and we've also discussed the list of these languages. And I've mentioned Ireland, and I mentioned Austria, because German was also. I've also mentioned this principle of legal certainty. You can't go around deciding things in a language which people don't understand. Ireland, when Ireland joined the Union, quite honestly, they couldn't find anybody who couldn't speak English. And that was weakened very much the position of Irish, even if the negotiators had requested official status for the language. But it's not very clear they were very interested in that. So it was the Irish's fault. And right at the end, I'll give you some recent news which tells you about changes that have been requested to this criterion. Now, since the European Economic Community was founded in 1957-58, a number of languages have become officially recognized within those member states. For instance, Corsican has acquired a legal status. Frisian in the Netherlands has acquired an official status. Catalan has acquired an official status. So these languages could not have been on the list in the first place, but there's no real reason why they couldn't be on the list right now. I've mentioned this principle of equality of all working and official languages. But if you look at the figures here, you will find that the oral use of languages by members of the commission inside, this is officials of the commission, not the commissioners themselves, in a study done in the 1980s, showed that French was by far the most predominant language actually used by people to converse. English came in second place, and there was a little bit of German, enough to put it in third place, and virtually no other language used by commission officials, unless they happened to be from the same part of the world and could converse. So basically what we're saying here is that the use of international languages for communication purposes was reduced to pretty well two. And in written texts, French was even more dominant, and English pretty well cleared the whole of the rest. All the rest of the work was given to translators if that had to be done. And not the oral work, the written work, obviously. This has changed since the 1980s, because the new member states that have come in have strengthened the position of English, in fact. The Scandinavian countries have opted very clearly for English, for example, and the Baltic states as well. So, just to recap, the dark part, I'm not sure what color it is on the screen behind me, dark part were the original members of the EEC. Then there was a development northwards, basically. Then Greece, Spain, Portugal joined. Then the Scandinavian countries and Austria joined. And as you know, in the last batch, I think Malta changed color there just then. We have now got pretty well all of Western and Central Europe, and I would have thought all of the European countries that border onto the Mediterranean, except for the Adriatic. Let's move now to the second point, very briefly. In what language do the institutions correspond with the general public, with the citizens? And the treaty has a specific article which says that citizens have the right to address the institutions of the European Union in any of the treaty languages. Not in the official languages, any of the treaty languages. Nowhere in the treaty will you find the word official language or the word, well, the expression, working language. They're not in the treaty. The treaty just says the council will decide. It will decide on the rules governing languages. And the council decided in 1958. It was a simple decision, just four languages. There are plenty of international organizations that use four languages. Now, because of the first sentence, in other words, if you are a treaty language, if you speak a treaty language, then you can write to the Commission, for instance, or the Parliament in your own language and get a reply. That was lovely for the Irish, because they're included then alongside all the official and working languages, but the Catalans wanted to be there as well. And the easiest way was to say, well, let's make Catalan treaty language just like Estonian or Danish or Maltese or Italian or French or German or whatever. And there was quite a lot of popular pressure to try and get Catalan included as a treaty language, which just means that when they came to sign the book, which contains all the versions of the treaty, then there would be a version in Catalan added to the mountain. So in reply to this pressure, the Spanish government managed to achieve something so brilliant that it's absolutely useless in practice. And what they achieved was a special paragraph saying that if anyone really felt like translating the treaty into an official regional language, well, you know, we'll let them do it. And then if they give us that copy, we'll put it away in a drawer. I'm saying this slightly cynically because the practical consequence of that is zero. That doesn't make that language a treaty language. And therefore, the whole of the intention of this popular campaign to achieve treaty status was absolutely wasted or thrown away. Now, I refer here to a 2003 council meeting in Thessalonica when Greece had the presidency for 6 months of the council, of the union, in fact. And what they did was say, we're going to have something called an e-vote. I think we'll find it's here. There we are. We're going to have an e-vote. Citizens of Europe, please tell us what you're worried about, what concerns, what would you like the council to look into in detail? And I didn't discover this when they asked me, but I did discover what they had chosen from each member state. And they had chosen just one thing, I'm not quite sure on what grounds. They chose one item, which was then put to the votes of all the citizens. So they limited the number, and each member state had one question. And the question they chose from Spain, member state, was the text you have in white, and I've translated as accurately as I can from Spanish, which was the first paragraph, and Catalan, which was the second paragraph. Now, for reasons which will become evident, the council had to reply. And the council, in fact, reproduced this citizen, it's a lady, reproduced her question in the red text, which you will agree is not exactly what she was writing about. She was writing about her language and not about a general thing of minority languages. Anyway, why did they reply? Firstly, what did they reply, and then why did they reply? And the answer from the council was fairly pathetic. the European Union has created a strong political and legal framework for the protection of minorities and minority languages. That is simply, grotesquely untrue. I'm sorry, but it is not true. Secondly, according to the Constitution of Spain, which has nothing to do with it, Catalan is not a minority language since Catalonia is not a minority area. No one asked them. Catalonia is an important region, that's nice to know, with its own special place in the Spanish state. Absolutely wonderful, but of no practical use in answering this citizen's question. Now, why did they actually answer this question? Because of all the countries that put their question, and I think you'll find that there were more countries involved here than member states at that time. So, I mean, Estonians also chose, for instance, and Latvians and Lithuanians did. I don't think Malta's on the list, but Cyprus is, for instance. I may be wrong. They had the vote, and who voted? 110,000 people voted. Which of this list of 20, perhaps, items deserves the attention of the Council? And you'll see that was a fairly clear outcome, because 92%, I think it was, 92% of all the answers were, in fact, from Catalonia, by Catalans, saying, we want the Council to solve this. Why am I cutting a short story long? Sorry, it should be the other way around, but in this case, I'm going on a little bit insistently on this, just to underline the strength of public feeling about Catalan not being an official language of the Union. This was not obviously spontaneous, and this is one excellent example of the power of the internet and of email, and the mobilization of any number of networks of Catalan speakers and Catalan supporters was quite colossal. It really, made the news in newspapers and all. So, as I said, just useless paragraph was put in as a result, which has nothing to do with what the Catalans were asking for. Let's move briefly, because I'm not a specialist in the field, to the organization of the language services that had to meet the needs created by the first two points. Well, basically, the language services are for three separate functions, closely related but separate functions. Terminologists to decide what words should be used in each language to refer to the same concepts. Translators who can sit down and translate text from one language to the other using the terminology databases or data banks, and interpreters, which is a job which I would never choose because it must be like some air traffic controllers. You're under tremendous tension to provide instant solutions that people will accept. Those three separate functions, unfortunately, were developed separately by the Council, by the Commission, and by the Parliament. And it's only very recently, for instance, that the terminology databases have been unified. Well, I hope that the databases said the same thing at the very least, but it may be that a word was translated in one way by the Council into, I don't know, Polish, whatever, and a different way by the terminologists of the Parliament. I don't know. But they are unifying those services now. The Commission alone has a vast amount of work. It translates about 1.2 million pages, and I say it translated about 1.2 million pages of text even before this last enlargement. So I imagine the amount of translations that have to be done has further increased. And as I'm sure you know, every time a new member joins the Union, all the existing legislation that is applicable in that member state, in that new member state, has to be translated into the language or languages of that member state. And that right now is round about 90,000 pages of text. Now that is a tremendous training ground for translators. It really puts on the spot terminologists, and it's the kind of job that is a difficult task for countries with many million speakers, in other words, with a large body of professional translators. For Malta, you know, that's a kind of miracle, because it has had, if you like, a side effect of really underlining the economic value of professional training in the Maltese language. There are hundreds of people who can aspire to permanent jobs working for, from, in the Maltese language within the European Union institutions. Some people say that the cost of these services is so astronomic that why don't we all decide on, you know, a lingua franca? Oddly enough, it's English speakers that seem to argue along these lines. I mean, there must be some sort of coincidence here, because they would like English to be the lingua franca. And if it comes to the crunch, it already is. In other words, if we close down all these services, it might be that there wouldn't be all that much difference in practice in much of the working of the Commission or of Europe. But since from the very, very first day, this multilingual approach was adopted by the founding members, it has continued to exist ever since. And with 20 official languages and working languages, obviously the European Union is the most multilingual international organization in the world. I'm going to say international or national. I mean, I doubt you'll find a national institution which has that many official and working languages. At the same time, why are so many languages used in practice? Well, basically, they are interfaces so that anyone from any of these languages can relate to the institutions in that language. In other words, for any individual, these institutions are monolingual. They're in their own language. You can say the institutions of Europe are Maltese speaking. They speak Maltese. You can prove it any number of times. You can go to the website, just one click, and you are absolutely convinced with a complete structure that the Europa website is in Maltese. But you do have to click. Don't click on Portuguese. Okay? We can leave that to the Portuguese. I'm not saying anything new, but it's something to remember. It appears to be multilingual, but once people have put their headphones on, it isn't multilingual. It's in their own language. And there I've tricked you a little bit. And here I made reference to the Parliament. In order for this to happen, not only do you have to have a lot of interpreters at oral sessions, you have to have an awful lot of cabins around the room. And that is certainly the case in plenary sessions of the Parliament, for instance. But it isn't the case at committee meetings, because you would need probably rooms with more cabins, more space for the cabins, than for the people attending these committee meetings. So what you have, in effect, is an arrangement by which it is announced what languages will be usable within committee meetings. And there, people can put their foot down, they can put their hand up, sometimes you can find a system whereby a larger number of languages can be used, but a smaller number can be received. So you can say, I'm going to speak in Maltese, but it's okay, I can listen to it in, what did I say before? Portuguese. You all know Portuguese? You can listen to it in Portuguese. Or English, for that matter. Okay? So that is a trend right now, but it's obvious. I mean, there just simply are not enough committee rooms for all the languages to be used all the time. It's a physical problem as much as anything else. And once you've added up the total cost of all these services, and you work it out as a proportion, as a percentage of the budget of the EU, it really is not very much at all. It comes out to 2 or 3 euros per person per year. And I mean that, you know, €3 per person per year. So we're not talking in the end about a cost that cannot be borne by the union as a whole. There's a trick in the last sentence as well, because it says the institution, people can address the institutions of the union in their language, and the official and working languages of the institutions. What are the institutions? Well, it turns out that not every single office of the union is an institution of the union. And there are other offices like the patents office, for instance, which says, look, we've got five, five's enough, okay? And people have complained about this, and people have taken this to court, and people have lost their case. And they've lost their case because all this idea about all the official language and all the working language being equal, according to the court, the European Court of Justice, is, okay, it's a criterion, but it's certainly not legally enforceable outside the strict reading of the treaty. The fourth of the six that I'm going to refer to is foreign languages. Because, well, what a foreign language to one person may be the home language of another person, obviously. They realized fairly early on, in the 80s certainly, that you can't build a common labor market unless you encourage people to learn other languages. And who realized this first of all? The French. The French said, watch it. If we don't do anything at all, English will just wipe the slate clean. Look at schools. How many schools teach one foreign language? Right, let's have a look and see. There's only one country where English isn't the first foreign language taught. That's England, yeah? Where they probably teach more French. Whether they learn French or not is another matter. So what the French did in the late 80s and early 90s was to campaign within the commission to try and say, we don't want one foreign language in schools. We want two foreign languages in schools. We are more multilingual than anyone. We believe firmly in multilingualism. As you may have realized the other day, I'm not too keen on the language policies that France has had since the French Revolution. They basically wiped out multilingualism inside France and replaced it by monolingualism, with a whole discourse saying, if you're monolingual, you are kulunut, as we say in Catalan. You're the greatest. But as a friend of mine from Brussels constantly says, monolingualism is a curable disease. And he has been out trying to persuade people that bilingualism is also out of date and that we really should be going for trilingualism or quadrilingualism. And the sooner you start, probably the easier it is to learn a third language and a fourth language. Saying this in Malta is really a waste of time because you're fully aware of this. But the thing about trying to get a second foreign language taught in schools is that French, having lost the first cake, could get a good chunk of the second cake, if there was a second cake. And there has been this pressure and council statements on a number of occasions saying, please, member states, make sure that your students have two foreign languages at school, particularly at secondary school, and not just one. They haven't been all that successful. Because the pressure on the timetable in school curricula is very, very great. But that's in schools. There's also a high level of adult education, for instance, and what the commission put to the council and to the parliament and got through was a whole program, a legally binding program called the Lingua Program, to give support to anyone who wants to teach foreign languages or develop teaching material for languages or e-learning of foreign languages. That has come in more recently. And the Lingua Program, which is now within Socrates, you've heard of Erasmus, I'm sure some of you have actually participated in Erasmus. The Lingua Program action is within Socrates alongside Erasmus. And there, what they're trying to do is to give support to people so that foreign languages can be learnt and taught. Not all European languages, I may say, and we will see why. Because the only languages that are eligible for the lingua action are the official and working languages of the institutions. You think, well, that, there's a kind of bureaucratic reason for that part of the list. Irish as well. You say, oh, why? Why Irish and not another language? Well, it's just the Irish said, well, if you want us to vote for it, you'll have to put our language on the list, even if it isn't really their language or the language of most of the people. So they said, all right. And then the Luxembourgers said the same thing. Oh, we're not good. You know, we'll help you if you help us. So in fact, you can get a grant in Malta to train Maltese school children who want to learn Luxembourgish. And I imagine the queues would probably reach out into the middle of the Grand Harbour. And having said that, you can see the bottom line here, obviously, on the screen. There are also other languages for which you can get European funding to teach them. And these are not even spoken in the European Union. Norwegian and Icelandic, the queue might not be quite as long for Icelandic as I'm sure it is for Luxembourgish, you multilingual people. Icelandic and Norwegian are here because they are members of what used to be called EFTA, the Free Trade Association. They're not the only members, but they are the only members whose language is not already on this list. And then all the rest are just simply not there. Catalan, Welsh, Sorbian, Galician, Frisian, Basque. It is not possible to obtain European funding for the teaching of these languages. How far would the queue get to learn Sami in Malta? I doubt it would be very long. But why do you have to exclude languages? Why couldn't they make the text an open text and say, where there's a demand, there can be funding? And this is another source of grievance for Catalans, because you have all sorts of horror stories. There's one called Soccer Lingua. And Soccer Lingua is an excellent idea. It's to try and get these pin-up boys, the football stars, saying how keen they are on learning another language, or perhaps almost certainly they're not from where they're playing for. You know, they're Irish and they play in France, or they're German and they play in Sweden, or whatever. They are promoting perhaps their own language among the supporters of that particular club. Soccer Lingua has about 6 or 8 clubs in there, and all their languages are funded by Lingua except for one, because Barcelona Football Club is there and Catalan is not on the list. It can't be funded under Lingua. So in fact, the Barcelona Football Club is paying that completely on its own. Well, I think that is unfair. So you can sign a petition on the table outside afterwards, okay? The Lingua program is all very well, but it's sort of piecemeal. It's small little projects here and there all over the place. And I think the Commission reached the conclusion that it was high time to get the trumpets out and say, come on, people, lifelong learning, adult courses, why don't we all get interested in learning languages? They didn't answer that question. What they did was to try and create a kind of general awareness of the need for multilingualism. And what they did was make 2001 the European Year of Languages. Now, I was most amazed when I heard this, because European Union bureaucrats are not terribly imaginative, usually, I'm afraid to say. But then I heard, in fact, it was an idea of the Council of Europe. It was the Council of Europe, which has nothing to do organically with the European Union, that put out this idea, but they don't have you know, a leader. They are absolutely penniless. So they gave out the idea, and the European Union said, okay, we'll take the idea, we'll share it with you, and we'll fund this particular program, 1 year program. And here, for once, there was no limitation to the languages that could take part. So many minority languages also took part. However, on the website was in the short list of official languages of the European Union. This is the Spanish version. And what they did was open a forum for people to give their opinion about a number of different issues. Well, as you can imagine, I mean, this is a red rag before a Catalan bull. We don't like bullfighting, but we do like red rags. And what happened was that many, many Catalans took part in this forum complaining about the fact that there wasn't a Catalan version of this page. I think that was going too far, because, in fact, being a Council of Europe initiative as well, there were many, many other countries whose official and national languages didn't have a version here. But it doesn't matter. Red rag is always a red rag. And we had interventions like this one. I've reproduced this one here. I think it was written in English directly because of the second paragraph. And there was a sad question there saying, can't we get anywhere unless we are independent? And this was slapped in the face by many, many people who took part in the forum. Are you telling us that we have to be independent for our language to be acknowledged? The answer is very simple, yes. Because if you have a language which is not the official language of a member state, then you're not going to get very far. The fifth of the 6 points I will again refer to briefly is linguistic diversity as a whole and regional and minority languages. I'm not sure if I've shown you this cover before. It's the cover of one of a series of reports on the state of regional and minority languages in the European Union member states. And this particular one was one that I coordinated, a team of four, eventually three authors. This is called the Euromosaic. You can consult it on the website, on the Commission website now. And it just formed part of one of a series of European Parliament resolutions saying, look, you must do something about this issue. Minority languages are in a sorry plight in many countries. Please do something about it. At the bottom there, you can see a short reference to support for Eblul. I'm sure you all know what Eblul is. Yes? No. Of course. The European Bureau for Lesser Used Languages. Now, that was set up, it was almost on their knees, and the Commission saying, please, someone, set up a bureau of this sort. This is an organization which has representatives from all over Europe. All minority languages are represented in this bureau, and it's an NGO. But it's an NGO which is funded pretty well 100% by the Commission, with some support from the Irish government, for instance, but basically by the Commission. And it's an NGO that has to make a nuisance of itself. In other words, it has to act as a pressure group, as a lobby, and therefore it could really get into trouble if they decided to cut its funding. I haven't talked about funding. And from 1983, again, thanks to the European Parliament pressure, until the year 2000, there was money for projects, often small projects, to promote activities, publications, productions in these languages. Greek in the south of Italy. I don't know, Friulan in the north of Italy. Even things like Asturian in Spain. All these often small communities would get a grant from Brussels. And this would really raise their self-esteem and say, Brussels agrees that we organize a course in our primary schools to teach our own language. We have money to show it. And this, I think, was very, very valuable, particularly for the smaller communities. 2000 is not 2005, is it? That's some years back. There's been no money for this for some years. What happened? Well, what happened was very simple. This started up as a pilot scheme. And the Commission has a perfect right, particularly if the Parliament asks it to do so, to start up pilot schemes, to see if they work. And if they work after a time, then they have to become programs. That is, they have to go through the whole procedure to become legal. And they have to get, in the end, council approval. Well, this never got through that. It was a pilot scheme which didn't last 3 or 4 years, or 13 or 14 years. It lasted, 15. It lasted 15 years, and then a couple more. And somebody said, look, you can't have pilot schemes lasting 15 years. There are things which the commission cannot do unless there's a program, unless there's a council decision. And what had happened in 1998 was that this had been discovered, and the European Court of Justice had said, you're quite right, this cannot happen. It had nothing to do with language, it was another budget line, but it had been going for years and years and years. The commission did whatever it liked, there was no control there, basically, and the European Court of Justice said, let's have a look, none of these should go on. And this was one of the victims of that court decision, and the commission had a couple of years to say, right, well, we're going to start a different pilot scheme, just a couple of years, and then when the couple of years are over, we'll have a program. We'll get it through the Parliament and through the Council. Well, they tried and they didn't. They failed. And they failed for a very simple reason. The project they designed, which could have become a program, was called Archipelago. Which is a nice idea of, you know, variety, lots of little things all over the place. But the legal services of the commission said, this is a cultural program. And they said, no, it's an educational program. No, this is a cultural program. What's the difference, you may say? Well, the difference is very clear if you read the treaty. I hope you don't, because it's very, very boring. But in synthesis, the article on education says, well, as long as most member states agree, we can have a program here. Whereas the article on culture says, if even one member state doesn't agree, that doesn't get through. No, it has to be a unanimous vote. And the commission was perfectly clear about this. France, Greece would never vote for something promoting minority languages. They had enough trouble controlling them in France. In Greece, they didn't. Oh, no. Because in Greece, they said that we don't have any minority languages, so there's nothing to worry about. There are five. So the commission was caught off guard, particularly the DG for Education and Culture. They were caught off guard. What are we going to do now? So what they started to say was, well, let's get an action plan going on linguistic diversity, language learning, which includes regional languages in small handwriting underneath. That has been going for a couple of years, and it has managed to fund a number of projects. There's a project here called ADUM, which, as you all know, I'm sure, is Friulian for together. You knew that, didn't you? Yes. And this project here was more or less commissioned by the commission, but they only pay for half of it, which is a nice way of going about things. And that is an attempt to put onto a website information on all the European programs that do exist and that could perhaps be used to fund projects which have something to do with supporting a minority language or minority language community. And there are such programs. And we have been tracking them down. We've been discussing how to describe these programs and how they could be useful with the officials responsible for them. There's a last element here which I want to make reference to, because it says, this came from the Charter of Fundamental Rights. As you know, that's been built into the treaty. And it says, the Union will respect linguistic, cultural, and religious diversity. My question is, what do they mean by respect? If respect means we'll have nothing to do with it, we won't do anything, then in the case of religious diversity, I think that is perfectly respectable, and I don't know what they could do which was not respectful of religious diversity at European Union level. Can they respect cultural diversity? Well, I can imagine some sort of system where they would require everyone to agree and be fairly cautious about this. But how can you respect linguistic diversity if you only have a limited number of official languages? Every time you open your mouth, you're saying, Friulian is not official. Every time you open your mouth, you are telling people that there are some interfaces, there are some languages which are their own, and there are others which are just simply not available in those languages. The last reference I'd like to make before the news, let's say, is to other language-related programs. There was one in the, a very successful one in the 90s, which was called the MLIS program. I didn't invent the name, it sounds horrible. It's just simply Multilingual Information Society program. And there, a whole set of products and projects to develop software, for instance, in different languages was developed, and that worked very well. And they said, right, we'll repeat this and we'll build it into the IST, the Information Society Technology Program, which is functioning now and which is funding many, many languages in their efforts, for instance, to develop automatic translation systems, voice recognition systems. And in this area, I would hope that Maltese will really make the best of it and try and catch up with other languages. If you can answer a question on a telephone, they say, if you want to speak to the finance department, say yes, or yes or no. And if you say yes and it understands you, that's lovely. But if you reply in Maltese, it'll say, sorry, come again? Because Maltese probably doesn't have the voice recognition systems operating. And if I'm wrong, I'll be the first to leap for joy. And I'm ending now, and I hope there'll be a nice discussion, and I hope you will act as a translator privately for me so that everyone can exercise their right to use Maltese in this session, is two recent developments in 2004. Firstly, looks as if it's the second one. The Spanish government, under pressure from in the parliament, they don't have an outright majority, so they have to negotiate things, said, right, well, we will put in a request to the council to change the regulation for the very first time, apart from, or instead of, just simply adding new languages to the list of official and working languages, somebody is going to put in a request, in fact, to change the regulation and allow another group of languages to have a legal status. But why have I put the Irish government here in front? Because they heard the rumor. The Spanish government has written a letter announcing it's going to put in a request and saying, following the Irish example. And they said, what Irish example? They had heard that the Irish were going to make an official request for Irish to be added to the list. So not a formal change in the regulation, but an addition to the list of official and working language. When the Irish heard that, they said, my God, you know, we're now going to be mixed in with a whole range of languages that aren't treaty languages. You know, at least we're one step ahead of here. So let's be two steps ahead and put in our request quickly. So in chronological terms, the first request received by the council was from Ireland and the second one from Spain. The Irish request is very easy to explain. It's just simply to make Irish an official and working language like all the other treaty languages. The Spanish request is much more complex, and it would establish a second level of languages which are recognized so that, for instance, MEPs can use those languages in the parliament. But don't worry, council, we'll pay for it. So the request that comes from Spain says, don't turn us down on financial grounds. You know, you're paying an awful lot already. Don't worry, we'll pay for the cost of these extra services. Which probably means Catalans will pay for it in the end, I don't know. But that is the state of affairs right now in this particular issue. For the very first time, there's been a formal request by a member state to change the text of that 1958 regulation, which is the very first regulation that was adopted by the council. And I think there I have finished. If you want to see it again, stay seated. But I'm not going to repeat it because I think we should open the floor to questions and remarks. Thank you very much.
Grazie ħafna, Professor Strubel. Jekkaw mistoqsijiet.
Mela, jekk matul ix-xhur li ġejjin naraw li l-Kostituzzjoni Ewropea ma tiġix aċċettata, jew minn Franza, jew minn Danimarka, ikun min ikun. Taħseb li dan jista' jkun ta' periklu għal multilingwiżmu tal-Unjoni Ewropea?
I know people who voted against. They were asked their opinion for the very first time. Never before in Spain was anyone asked whether they liked or didn't like what was going on in Brussels, let's say. So for the very first time, opinions have been requested. At the same time, many people, I know people who have voted against it, me for instance, on the grounds that it isn't a step forward for countries that are already in. It has incorporated a charter which they had already approved, and they've reformulated the treaty without any substantial advancement for Catalans. In other words, unless you are a member state, you may not notice a difference. The chance of a regional authority having any impact, having a voice, being able to take anything to the European Court, all of this, it just isn't there. It hasn't emerged. That, coupled with the exclusion of Catalan as an official language, or the non-inclusion of Catalan as a treaty language, meant that people didn't feel happy in Catalonia. The same happened in the Basque Country. So in both those cases, there was a substantial vote against the treaty. If I lived in Madrid, I would have voted in favor, okay? You know, everything is relative, if you like. But a lot of people wanted to make their mark on these grounds. If you're referring specifically to multilingualism, well, you know, things haven't changed from our point of view. Okay? Thank you.
Et inxandru t-taħdita tal-professur Mikel Strubel mil-Katalonja fuq il-qada tal-lingwi fl-Unjoni Ewropea.
You're quite right. There's a tremendous amount of work, and the acquis communautaire, if you like, is one chapter, but the day-to-day amount of work that has to be translated, particularly for the official journal, which has to come out every day regularly, is enormous. One factor that has to be borne in mind is that the translating services do have a considerable amount of finance to, in fact, not employ people, but in charge people with particular translations outside the immediate staff. If that were not the case, they simply could not cope, I would say, ever. Obviously, the people who are luckiest are the people from whom most documents, or from whose language most documents are being translated. If they have been written in English, the English translators don't have, or the British don't have any work to do. And that happens with English and French. So, in fact, most of the work is not being done by the English translators or the French translators, but by all the others. And in general, I think it would be true to say that the larger languages are making quite a fat profit out of this arrangement, and that there should be money for the smaller languages to compensate over and above what we're talking about now, which is strictly the funds for translators and interpreters. Thank you for the question.
Et inxandru t-taħdita tal-professur Mikel Strubel mil-Katalonja fuq il-qada tal-lingwi fl-Unjoni Ewropea.
For the status as such, it doesn't mean anything on the face of it. What concerns me more is the habit that you Maltese will get ingrained because of the absence right now of Maltese versions of many documents, the habit of not clicking on the Maltese version of the Europa website, for instance. Having said that, I know that some programs simply don't make all the documents available in all languages. If you go to the Cordis website, cordis.lu, which gives information about research projects and programs, there you'll find a lot of things are just in English and French and German, but nothing more. And I think that is highly debatable on legal terms, quite honestly. But that's Maltese and many, many more languages. So I'm worried now to learn that this postponing of the full implications of Maltese status was not discussed in Maltese society. It's an admission of failure, if you like, but at the same time, I can't underline sufficiently the huge volume of work that is involved, and it is exactly the same amount of work for Malta with 400,000 inhabitants as for Poland with 40 million. It's exactly the same amount of work. So, you know, per capita terms, I think what has been done in any case is a miracle. Okay, not enough of a miracle, not a big enough miracle, but a miracle anyway.